Philip Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to a very special edition of the Empire Podcast. Warren Beatty is one of the most legendary figures in cinema as an actor, producer, writer, and director. He's been involved in classics like Bonnie and Clyde, The Parallax View, Shampoo, Dick Tracy, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and many, many more over a career spanning nearly six decades. After a Kubrickian hiatus of 18 years, during which he had several kids with his wife, Annette Bening, he's back with Rules Don't Apply, part Hollywood love letter, part tale of sexual politics, and part story about the later years of Howard Hughes, the infamous billionaire whom Beatty plays. I spoke to Beatty this week in a top London hotel, as they say in things like this, and what followed was a freewheeling and fun conversation with an absolute legend. Oh, and Warren Beatty was there too. Now, before we begin, some notes. Beatty is a man who weighs his words very carefully, as you'll see when I ask him about politics. But he was also relaxed and conversational about his brilliant career, so much so that he doubled the length of the interview and even found time to eat cake halfway through. So apologies if you hear some munching. But we talked about tons of stuff, including, of course, Rules Don't Apply, Bonnie and Clyde, The Parallax View, Elvis Presley as well. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Here he is, the great Warren Beatty. We are delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the great Warren Beatty, producer, director, star, writer of Rules Don't Apply. Have I missed any out? It's hard to see. It's hard to keep track.
Don't tempt me. Yeah.
That's four jobs, which I imagine is four times the pay as well, which is not bad.
Not necessarily.
What's your favorite aspect of that, of the producing, direction, writing, and acting? If someone told you your next movie, you could only do one, what would you prefer?
Well, I would have to say probably producing.
Really?
Because in my, you know, it's kind of a bad word among many, the producing. Mm-hmm. But when I began, I realized that the people that I was lucky enough to meet, because I was this kid, mm-hmm. and I came into Hollywood having made a movie with Kazan, who was extremely good, and the picture worked. And yeah. So suddenly I was embraced by Sam Goldwyn, Daryl Zanuck, David Selznick, on and on and on. I could go, and Sam Spiegel.
Wow.
And I realized that they were the boss.
Yeah.
So I like being the boss. I also like being the person who puts the committee together. Because yes. I think movies are made by committees.
Yes.
And then various praise is heaped upon various people. But what I think is the most fun is to have a dialectic that can include friendly arguing.
Yeah.
Sometimes passionate arguing, and then have the director mm-hmm. to have the final decision. Mm-hmm. I like the process of working with a bunch of people.
Yeah.
And hearing. I'll tell you who got me onto that at the beginning. I was lucky enough to know Stanley Kubrick very well.
Yeah, of course.
At the before he was, what's the word for Stanley?
Where do you begin? Genius, yeah. Recluse, yeah. All the above.
Okay, I've avoided the word God. Yes, yeah. Stanley was so much fun.
Yeah,
and he always said to me. Always have arguments, but never have a one-on-one argument. Always have at least three people present for an argument. Okay. And four is better, maybe, or five or six. But if they're just two of you and you're arguing, it too easily becomes an ad hominem contest.
Yeah.
And to avoid that. So I really enjoy that element of it. It's I don't like to be lonely. Now, yes. There have been times when I have produced and directed and written and acted. By the way, this is one of them. I did it with Reds. I did it with Heaven Can Wait. I did it with Bulworth.
Yeah, of course.
It's not as much fun. I could make certain sexual analogies, you know?
Can't imagine what you mean.
You're right.
Yeah. It's more fun with three people. It's more fun with four people.
Well, I didn't want to go that far, but let's say it's more fun not being alone. Let me put it that way.
Let's leave it at that.
Yeah, I want to be very careful about that. Yeah, yeah. Sometimes...
Because somehow my words will end up as your words. People will listen to this and go,
yes,
Warren Beatty said...
I should be very careful.
Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely, yeah. Of course.
No, it's better that... it's better not to do it alone. And but even when you're doing it alone, you're not really doing it alone, because... it takes a lot of people to make a movie.
Absolutely. But it's interesting you chose producing, Warren, because I've read so much over the years about your acting, your producing, your directing. The one thing I don't really hear or read much about is your writing process. What is that like for you?
I think you could call it insane. It's in constant flux. Mm-hmm. There are so many things that you see happening, and when you acknowledge that they're happening, then that has been a change that must be respected the following day.
Yeah, of course.
I always come back to that axiom that character is plot. Mm-hmm. But then you have to say, well, particularly in a movie, casting is character.
Yes.
So then casting becomes plot.
Yes.
So you, it's kind of a form in which you deal with what you get. And you might have had one thing in mind, and the actor gives you something else better.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's not better, but if it's better, you certainly take it.
Yeah. Or it can spark you off in a different direction.
It puts you into a different... And something can be made very clear with one shot that can eliminate three pages. I won't try to be funny here.
But did that happen with this movie? Because I know that a movie about, this isn't a Howard Hughes biopic, but a movie about Howard Hughes has been floating around in your head for
a number of years. I think it's a movie about two young people who are... strongly affected by their religious backgrounds, mm-hmm. who come to Hollywood, mm-hmm. Doesn't have the religious present, mm-hmm. that Bible Belt has, who come to Hollywood, both of whom to work with a man who represented power and money and publicity and mystery and a certain amount of lascivious behavior, etc., and have to cope with. So I always felt he was a good obstacle.
Yes.
For this relationship, just as the consequences of American Protestant Puritan sexual repression that made us the laughingstock of other countries is an obstacle to a love affair. And a love story needs an obstacle.
Is that where you started, though? Or did you start with Howard Hughes and then the love story grew from that?
No, I started with wanting to do a story of coming from Virginia, the girl in 1958, and the boy comes from Fresno. That's when I came to Hollywood. And the more I thought about Howard Hughes as the central figure, I'd have to say it's a kind of a triangle.
Yeah.
But it's definitely not a biopic. And I also question the truth of anyone who went so far out of their way to be mysterious as Howard Hughes, or I sometimes say Greta Garbo.
Yes.
I mean, enough with the mystery. and by the way, that would not be possible today with the technology that we are either, you could say, graced with or saddled by. That we would know things about people that,
of course,
depending on how they got out of a taxi, you know, it would be that kind of, I'd have to say, phony mystery.
Yeah.
Doesn't really. That's not fair to say phony mystery. Mm-hmm. That kind of a mystery.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
Or self-created mystery is difficult now.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, you haven't made a movie, you haven't directed a movie in 17, 18 years, but it's not like you have been, as Howard Hughes was, or Stanley Kubrick was, you have not been a recluse. You've been there living your life.
Well, I have a life. Yeah. I have these four kids now.
Yeah.
And it's the best thing that has ever happened to me. And each one of them are more interesting to me and more fun and
yeah.
than any 50 movies. And so I had a rather extended, I guess what you would call, I wouldn't call it bachelorhood, I would call it unmarriedhood.
Yes.
I was, the thing that I was always afraid of was not marriage, but divorce.
Yes. So film suddenly became something that was secondary in your life, or maybe even...
Well, I didn't want to just go in and take acting gigs.
Yeah.
To do a movie, for me to do a movie acceptably, I have to be pretty much concentrated on it. Now I'm going into what they call empty nest syndrome.
Yes.
I think that... I'll be doing more of that, but also I spent a lot of time, and I guess it's a luxury that was afforded to me by having an early success with Kazan and Splendor in the Grass, mm-hmm. and being sort of becoming well known by 1959 and mm-hmm. 1960.
Yeah.
I have spent a lot of my life in political activity.
Mm-hmm.
That was hard for me to, I don't want to use the word escape, hard for me to not be interested in.
Yeah, of course, course. I've read several profiles about you, Warren, where you say that you had no real interest in running for office because you didn't think you were qualified enough.
I don't think I said I wasn't qualified enough. Mm-hmm. I think I might have said I wasn't generous enough.
okay.
I think I was qualified.
Uh-huh.
I think it's possible I was quite qualified.
overqualified, perhaps.
Well, I wouldn't say overqualified because I don't think anybody is. But I would say that I wasn't. Generous enough. I used to think that running for office would be like running for crucifixion, and I went through some campaigns with some. I've been through quite a number of presidential campaigns.
Of course, yeah.
And I was never unselfish enough to do that.
Looking at the current landscape, where we are now politically, do you maybe regret not running for office? Do you think I could have made a difference, given who's in the White House at the moment?
I didn't hear you.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Sorry. I'll ask it again. Do you sometimes feel that maybe you should have run?
Uh, I think I should continue to pretend I didn't hear you.
It might be for the best.
Well, for one thing, here I am. I have a movie, and then I want the movie to be understood. I don't want people to think, oh, they're going to go see a biopic of Howard Hughes, because it's not. And I want to make it straight, and so on. On the other hand, it's so irresistible to me to be talking about things that are also irresistible to you to talk about.
Absolutely.
And that has become theater.
Yeah.
And although I've always been a liberal, you know, some of my good friends have been conservatives. Ronald Reagan was a friend of mine.
Yeah. I had
a lot of fun with him. I would get in a jocular argument with him every time we get together. We'd have a lot of fun. He once said to me, you have to remember now, he said to me this when he had invited me to bring Reds to the White House, a 3.5-hour movie about a communist.
Yeah.
You know, so at intermission, by the way, last movie made with an intermission, he said to me, what you got to remember now is that there is no business but show business. And he was not joking. He was very serious, and he said, "I don't know how anyone could be president today without being an actor."
Yeah, of course.
And he wasn't being funny.
Of course.
So when you the word that when you start talking when I start talking on this subject, the word that I have to avoid over and over and over is excrement from the bull, and it relates to money.
Yeah.
What I would say, special interest money in American politics. So, the closeness or the intimacy of my life with politics and politicians. The bottom line is no. I don't think I should have done it. I think that by the time I got around, for instance, to doing Bullworth, I thought there's only one way to do this, and is to do it funny, because the situation is preposterous.
Yeah.
There's always this subject of the conflict between art and politics, politics and art, and then if one is pretentious enough to call movies an art.
Yeah.
And I always quote David Lean, who once said to me that that movies are the great near art form of the 20th century.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, there's.
So you're not quite. You're
money
not,
does yeah. get in the way. Oh my goodness! Look at this.
Oh well, cakes.
Money. This is
actual cakes.
It's very beautifully laid out.
Nothing but the finest here, Warren.
Yeah. My goodness. But the money does get in the way of art, and money does get in the way of politics.
Absolutely.
Are you familiar with my political background at all?
I am, yes.
Yeah. So you know I've been there.
You've been there. You absolutely
and,
have.
And I've seen what it has cost very good men and women.
Yeah. It takes a certain very interesting, very stubborn may not be the right word, but a very interesting type to go into politics knowingly, I think. Especially someone who's been so close as you have, and it can see what it's done to people over the years and the way it's chewed people up and spat them out. But it's fascinating nonetheless. I mean, you mentioned David Lean there, Warren, and again, in a previous profile I read of you, you said that how you came to London and how you became friends with David Lean and how he talked to you an awful lot. And I just wanted to know what that friendship was like and the sort of things that he would say to you.
David Lean once asked me to do a movie, and This is too interesting to just pick one. I think we should make a deal here that we should cut them in half.
Okay.
Because
you do that.
You know, I'll take the one that you wanted, and you'll take the one I wanted, or something. But if we cut them in half,
everyone wins.
Be half.
Everybody wins.
It's what we would call a redistribution of wealth, which is what we're basically talking about here. He had asked me to do a movie. And I didn't want to do the movie because I wanted to play the other part. And he was very impatient with me. I have to be... I let me think about this now. I don't want to be indiscreet.
Of course. Of course.
I'd love to tell you the story, but I don't know you well enough.
This has to be off, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I don't want to waste your time.
All right.
But after we finish, I'll tell you the story.
Okay. All right.
But
and I won't communicate it to anybody that you have my
but
word.
I did David Lean a big favor.
I did. And, oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And I never heard from him.
Okay.
And then a few years later, he came to Hollywood. And he called me and he said, I think I owe you a thank you. I said, oh, really? And then we went out and had dinner. Mm-hmm. I have never had such specific, frank advice as I got from David Lean.
Wow.
And, yeah.
Amazing.
But I would tell you this story. I'm just thinking about in the story, how many people involved in the story are alive? And so far, I can only think of one.
Okay.
And there are about eight other people. But yeah.
Okay. Okay.
He was great.
All right.
And but that reflects back onto the, you said about if you had to pick a spot,
yeah.
You know, and I always think of Sam Spiegel.
Yes.
And David Lean, how they said they'd never work together again, and then they worked together again. and the importance of collaboration.
Absolutely. I mean, you have, over the years, met pretty much everybody there is to meet, whether in politics or film. It's an extraordinary cavalcade of people that you've met over the years. But the one person you didn't meet...
Is Howard Hughes.
Is Howard Hughes.
Yeah. No, you're leaving out someone.
I'm leaving out.
Of equal importance.
Who is? Greta Garbo?
Yes.
There we go. I was going, because you mentioned her earlier on.
Yeah.
Okay. But you came close to Howard Hughes. You were in the same.
As far as I know, I might have come
vicinity.
Close to Greta Garbo.
When did you not meet Howard Hughes? I want to know the story.
When did I not meet him?
Yeah, because you came very close, didn't you? You were in a hotel, and he was. He may have been there,
huh?
He may have been at the.
Well, I'll tell you the story. Okay. I've told it so many times that you probably won't print it.
Well, I'll get the best version of it now.
Huh?
I'll get the best version of it because you've honed it down. This is perfection.
Well, I was afraid. I was very young, but I was whatever they call it, a movie star or something like that, and I was. I thought I was being followed by the tabloids, and often I go way back. And I was at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and I thought a couple of guys were following me. So finally, I called the desk and I said, "I want to tell you how disappointed I am that you are allowing the tabloids to follow me." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, could you hold on, Mr. Beatty?" And I said, "Yes." I was talking at the desk.
Yeah, of course.
On the telephone. He called me back and said, "Mr. Beatty, those people are not with the tabloids." I said, "Well, how do you know?" "Well, they're with Mr. Hughes." I said, "Do you mean Howard Hughes?"
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Yeah. Are you telling me I'm in the next suite from Howard Hughes?" "Well, we don't know." "Well, what are you saying?" "Well, he has eight suites." I said, "Eight suites?" "Yes, but confidentially, Mr. Bates, he also has five bungalows."
Wow.
I said, "Eight suites and five bungalows. Now, there's a comedy. And that was my first near, but not that I ever really, I knew a number of people who knew him very, very well. Uh-huh. I knew Kirk Kerkorian, I knew Greg Boutzer, I knew Jane Russell, I knew Gene Simmons, I knew Terry Moore, I knew, it goes on and on, Faith Domergue. People spoke very highly of him. People liked Howard Hughes. He was not a bad guy. I feel that there was something deep within him that might have liked to have been a movie actor.
Quite possibly, yes.
He sort of handled his movements, etc., in a way that Greta Garbo did.
Mm. And it's interesting that there is a version of that bungalow suite story in Rules Don't Apply. It's a slight twist on it, where he has numerous suites at a hotel. And there's a very funny scene with Oliver Platt trying to find out Howard Hughes is staying.
That's where those jokes come
from.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
Yeah,
which is something you sat on for, what, close to 40 years?
What's that?
You sat on that story for close to 40 years before making it into a film. Which is
what do you mean? It's sat on your kindergarten for 100 years. I mean, something happens. It's not like. Mm-hmm.
But there's a really interesting talk about layers. There's a really interesting layer that runs throughout Rules Don't Apply, which is this blending of fact and fiction. So you have Howard Hughes, who's a real person who existed. And you have wrapped around it this fictional story. How did you know? Was it a difficult balancing act getting the injections of fiction and fact?
What I think is that people who say they have fact don't know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Let's print.
I used to have a quote of Napoleon's when I started the movie that said, "History is a set of lies agreed upon." I had another one from Henry Ford that said, "History is bunk."
Yeah.
If you're making a movie and you're pretending to be someone else, you know, who are you kidding?
So, well, they say, you know, cinema is truth 24 frames a second, but right. Not in this case.
So you what you do is you try to take what is involved in that person's life and say what you want to say with it. With all due respect to Clyde Barrow, mm-hmm. I'm not really much like Clyde.
Yeah, this is true.
There are times when I thought maybe I will go ahead and call the character by another name.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But I thought, no, there's something about the fame that he constructed for himself that sort of meaningful, because I mean he went out of his way to be well known,
of course, absolutely,
but didn't want the details known and wanted to have a sense of privacy. All of this is a sort of of the self-merchandising of a movie star.
Yeah, absolutely.
How he did present himself in public, and he really did. He had a ticker tape parade.
Well, he was a showman.
He was a showman.
He was flamboyant in so many ways.
He was a showman.
And by sticking with Howard Hughes, I think you have a really ready-made, very juicy character to get into. I mean, we hear him before we see him in the movie, but his entrance with that scene with Lily Collins is very interesting, where he comes in, he's obscured in shadow, then he inspects her, he's basically inspecting her. Mm-hmm. Very mysterious, very enigmatic scene. A lot of fun to play, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah. I'm afraid that I don't take Howard Hughes as seriously as maybe some do.
That's a fair point. Fair point.
Yeah.
You also mentioned there, Warren, Clyde Barrow, and Bonnie and Clyde, amazingly, is 50 years old this year. And I imagine your thoughts turn towards movies when they hit anniversaries. Obviously, you reunited with Faye Dunaway at the Oscars, which I believe some people saw the Oscars. I think there was something that happened at the Oscars, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. What was it like, though? I mean, do you think about Bonnie and Clyde? Do you think about what that movie meant to you in your career?
Well, it was an interesting. Sure, at a certain point, I thought I'm going to have to take charge myself and create what I do. Now, in what stages will I do it? And I think I felt that in my first movie, and who helped me to feel that or to think that was Kazan.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it took me a while to go ahead and admit that I was going to direct. I could have directed Bonnie and Clyde. I didn't want to. Mm-hmm. I wanted to have a dialectic that would make me feel freer, really.
Yeah.
And I always felt, that's why you asked me if I had to pick one job.
Yeah.
It would be putting it together and saying, okay, now we're going to have an argument every night. You're the director, I'm the producer, and if we don't have something to argue about, we'll find something to argue about. And we will have someone else present.
Yes.
And we will argue it out. Now, when I did this on the first picture that I did with as a producer, which was with Arthur Penn, who was a very good director, I had done a movie with him called Mickey One, in which I simply felt it was the obligation of the actor to comply with whatever the auteur.
Yes.
Although he hadn't written Mickey One, and I never questioned. So Arthur, I asked Arthur if he wanted to direct Bonnie and Clyde, and he turned me down. I asked Willie Wyler, George Stevens. I was turned down by 10 directors. I didn't want to direct it myself. I came back to Arthur and I said, look, let's do this movie and have an argument every night. And then we'll have someone else present so that we can't, it doesn't be just an ad hominem contest. And then in the end, the final decision will be made by the director, and you're the director. But I get to talk as much as I want. And the irony of it, and we both laughed about this, because I would wind up at the end of the discussion 60% of the time having his opinion, and he would wind up 60% of the time having my opinion. It was fascinating. And this continued right up until the picture was finished. It was really enjoyable.
Yeah, but as an actor, as you say, you have to, initially you thought maybe you had to do everything that the director said, but as a producer actor, that's not the case.
So no, it's because in advance I said no, I'm going to discuss everything.
Okay. So
everything.
So it wasn't a case of if Arthur Penn said something that you as an actor did not want to do, you would not do it.
I would discuss it.
You would discuss it first, absolutely.
And I remember particularly one incident where Arthur had an idea where he wanted Bonnie and Clyde to enact their own funeral.
Yes.
But it looked like things were... And I just thought it was a terrible idea. And I said, this is just, you know, it's very pretentious. It's very... And no, he really wanted to do it. And so we argued and argued and argued. And then that's when we were in Texas. We didn't shoot this till we came to California. Uh-huh. I thought, maybe this will be a good idea. And so I spent about 3 days not saying anything, and then I was really into the idea, and we were ready to shoot. And you know what I'm going to say, don't you?
By all means.
I walked in and I said, you know, Arthur, you were right about this. It's going to be... This is the point. They did know what was going to happen to them, and they saw it. And I'm ready. I'm ready. And he said, "Well, I have to talk to you."
I've got some bad news, Warren.
Yeah,
I've got some bad news.
Yeah, and we didn't do it. The funeral, mm-hmm. But. That's kind of the fun of the game of making movies, is to be able to kick it around and kick it around. And it helps with all of the changes of mood that people who are moody enough to be making movies. Benefit by.
It's interesting. I wonder what your Bonnie and Clyde would have been like. And you wanted to direct that.
Well,
you...
I feel that Bonnie and Clyde was my Bonnie and Clyde.
Indeed, but as a director, well, what that would have been...
It wouldn't have been as good.
Really?
Okay. No, because I think that people would have been reluctant to change my mind about things. Mm-hmm. And when an atmosphere exists where people feel free to say what they think, mm-hmm. but then it has to have a center. It has to have the final decision.
Yes.
And that should be with the director. Otherwise, it doesn't work, in my opinion. It's not, you can't have the final decision by the producer.
And so, did you want to direct? Eventually, you did direct, obviously, with Heaven Can Wait. But did you come close to directing anything else before that? Were you looking at Shampoo necessarily? Were you looking at the Parallax View as directorial vehicles?
Shampoo, I thought about it a lot. Mm-hmm. But then Hal, incredibly collaborative. When I think of Hal, and I don't remember of Hal, I don't remember, Hal was not as ready to engage in disagreement. He would listen. Mm-hmm. And then Hal would make a decision, and I don't remember ever feeling that he made the wrong decision. And then Robert Towne and I would be sort of loudmouthed between each other and talk, and then Hal would. So it was a good. It was, but as Stanley used to say, stay away from the one-on-one.
Don't do it. Don't do it.
It's then you start questioning the personnel involved, and Now, you mentioned the parallax view. That was very interesting because the parallax view was a... It took place during a writer's strike. And we had a script that was not in good shape at all.
Oh, really?
And we had to start shooting. And so Alan Pakulin and I sat and one of my chief memories was looking over on my right and seeing a table where a bunch of the crew is playing poker, and then over on my left another table where the crew is playing poker because Alan and I were trying to decide what the hell we were going to say, and we had Gordon Willis, who was
amazing,
a great cinematographer, and it was a very enjoyable, very collaborative process. But there's no way to say it other than we were writing it as we went along. And the same thing happened on a movie called McCabe and Mrs. Miller with Bob Altman.
Yes.
Did you know about Altman? Did you know him at all?
I never had the pleasure, sadly.
Talk about flexible. And he really was a very, very talented person.
Yeah.
And was very shrewd about the value of improvisation.
Yeah.
That's another movie that kind of got written as we went along.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really? It feels sometimes like not all, but most Robert Altman movies were made on the hoof in a way. And there's an elliptical energy to them. They feel very much in the now, in the present.
There is an urgency to improvisation.
Yeah.
Bob would shoot with usually about four cameras. Wow. We were shooting. It was an interesting process where a bunch of the small parts were being played by people who were actually, the movie was about building this town.
Yeah.
And we were shooting it where a housing development was being built. And so a number of these people grew beards and were in the movie.
Amazing.
It was very, very interesting. The character that Julie played, in the book, was not English at all, and so a very close friend of Julie's, who knew Cockney rhyming slang very well, and I knew Southern slang from my father's family in Virginia, and we would get together with. And write it as we went along.
Amazing.
And there's something to be said for that. It can bring a kind of energy and discovery that the urgency of the situation inspires.
Yeah.
And if it didn't cost money to do it the other way, or excuse me, to do it that way, it would be done more often because it means it can be more creative to not have a plan.
Yes, of course, of course. And it's interesting, as you say, it felt very much like the parallax view for you. It fascinates me that. That you and Alan Pakula made that film on the hoof, because it is one of the great conspiracy thrillers. It's one of the great endings in cinema history as well. So did you have the ending from the off? Did you know how that movie was going to finish?
We went back and forth and back and forth. And in general, yes, we did. Mm-hmm. It was very enlightening to see how much Gordy Willis's use of light mm-hmm. affected story. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, when Gordon came up, everyone was outraged in Hollywood, saying, "Turn the lights on," you know, and he didn't.
He didn't. No, he really didn't. He didn't. Yeah. And just a couple of last things, Warren. I read again. It was a Vanity Fair profile of you recently. You've talked recently about how you turned down Superman, how you turned down Kill Bill, Boogie Nights, all these movies, and you have your reasons for them. That's which is great. The one movie that I...
Other people talk about.
You've talked about them as well.
I will acknowledge it if they say, did you, you know, but I don't bring it up when I've turned down movies.
Indeed. But one movie that was on the list of movies that you had passed on or come close to making was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And I'd never read this before, that you had wanted Elvis Presley, to star in that movie with you.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yes.
Did you know Elvis?
I did not know Elvis, and I had dinner with his widow.
Okay.
Not long ago, and I said, and I told her this story and how much I appreciated Elvis, and he said, "I have to tell you that he felt the same way about you." And I was very touched by that.
Wow.
But I didn't know Elvis.
Oh, wow. So it was an instinctual thing that he would be... Because I think Elvis is a better actor than people give him credit.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Yeah. And that's why I thought, now that could be really interesting.
But at the time, I imagine you said Elvis Presley, and the reaction was not that positive.
It was... That's right.
It's a shame. It's a shame. I can see it in my head. I can see it. It would work. It worked out okay, obviously. The movie was pretty good.
It was good.
Those other guys, what are their names? Newman and Redford, they were fine.
But,
you know, Beatty and Presley together, jumping off the cliff at the end, that would have been great.
Well, you
never know. But what is next for you, Warren? Have you now that you're at the empty nest stage of your
right? As I said, I have a couple of things juggling around in my head. If I say what they are, then people will say, "Hey, he's been working on this forever, and that must not be very good," or whatever. So I refrain from.
Yes.
From.
So if I were to say Dick Tracy, what would you say?
I would say, "I didn't hear you."
I'm not falling for that one again.
Yeah.
I won't repeat it.
Yeah.
And then the very last thing before I let you go is, I mentioned you and Faye at the Oscars, and I have to ask about it to an extent. That was a very interesting moment. I think it was a great moment in Oscar history. I think it was an incredible moment of positivity, ultimately. My theory is that you had recognized something was wrong and were trying to show the card to Faye. Is that what happened? Is that...
Well, I had a kind of choice, I guess, if I were to go back and try to remember the moment. I opened it, and I thought it was a misprint.
Yeah.
That they had, by mistake, they had put the name of the actress on the same card.
Uh-huh.
And then I thought, I didn't want to take the chance of stopping the show and saying, "Hey, we've got a problem here."
Yeah.
But I thought that if Faye looked at the card and looked at me, then there would be at least two people to say there could be a problem here.
Yes, yes.
And she was saying to me, hurry up.
Get on with it.
And so rather than try to be funny about it, I thought, okay, show her the card.
Yeah.
But that was very much required that she be the person who read the card.
Yes.
That's part of the thing. I open the envelope after saying something.
Yeah.
I hand it to her, and she says what the card says.
Yep. Shared responsibility.
And so she said it a little sooner than I thought she would say it. I was kind of, you know, joking with her because she said, "Hurry up! You're impossible." And I thought, there could be a problem.
There could be a problem.
But it's interesting that so much was made of it.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, I've spoken recently to Barry Jenkins, the director of Moonlight, and three of the actors from Moonlight, and they thank you because it's an amazing moment, and no one is ever going to forget that Moonlight won the Best Picture in 2017. Or did it? I don't know. Who knows? We never know.
Yeah,
but Warren Beatty, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you. You can have some more biscuits now. It's great.
Well, I was a little disappointed by the bite of that one.
And that is it. And if you're wondering if Warren Beatty did tell me that anecdote that he stopped himself from telling, well, he did. And it was glorious. And I'm taking it to my grave. Hope you enjoyed the extended interview with an absolute legend. The regular Empire podcast is out every Friday, so please subscribe to that if you don't already. And if you can, leave us lovely reviews on iTunes as well, if that's your bag. No harm in that whatsoever. Our next special podcast is likely to be a spoiler special for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 with the film's writer-director James Gunn. That's going to be out after the film opens in the US, so keep your eyes peeled for that as well. Until then, I've been Chris Hewitt. You've been listening to the Warren Beatty special, and thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.